I decided to start right from scratch with the Apocrypha because I thought there might be lots of people who don't know what it refers to. And there gets a bit of confusion because the Apocrypha that I'm talking about is written between the Old and New Testament. There are other books called the Apocryphal Gospels, which are written after the New Testament. And I just wanted to make sure that people understood that I wasn't referring to those. So. The word Apocrypha means of doubtful authorship or authenticity. It can also mean of doubtful sanction, uncanonical, and it can mean false or spurious. So I think all of these probably apply. The word apocryphosa means hidden. It's a word used since the 5th century to describe a group of books written in the period between the Old and New Testaments, the authorship and inspiration of which is contested. The Jews reject it, the Catholic and Lutheran churches include it, and the Protestant churches in general consider it to be uninspired writing. It's not currently included in the Hebrew Bible. These books are often referred to as deuterocanonical books, a term which literally means a second principle rule or criterion. It's a term used for these books since the 16th century by the Catholic Church and Eastern Christianity. The books contained in the Hebrew Bible are by contrast referred to as protocanonical, which comes from the Greek and means belonging... Basically, deuterocanonical, which comes from the Greek, means belonging to the second canon. The word Apocrypha refers to the whole set of texts. The books which comprise this Apocrypha, written between the Old and New Testaments, are number 1, 1st Esdras, number 2, 2nd Esdras, then Tobit, Judith, additions to Esther, the Wisdom of Solomon, Ecclesiasticus, Baruch, the Letter of Jeremiah, Prayer of Azariah, Susanna, Bel and the Dragon, Prayer of Manasseh, 1st Maccabees and 2nd Maccabees. So 15 in all, and I've got 10 minutes, so I thought I'm going to have to cut a different path through all of this. Some of the books are short additions to Old Testament books, some are short stories or novels, and some are moral teachings. Others are historical records. All in some way address the problems of Israel and Judah in exile and or after their return to Jerusalem. Some of the most interesting passages in these texts deal with the nature of sin, responses to adversity, and how to be put right with God. In these passages, we see the influence or impact of Persian and Greek cultures on the religion of Israel and the Jewish response. In the book of Susanna, the young prophet Daniel claims that the two elderly judges who conspired against Susanna sinned because they took their eyes off God and then they were deceived by beauty. Christ will redefine this judgment to say that beauty isn't the problem. The desire to possess that which we admire but are not entitled to is the problem. Thus, the problem is in the motive and action of the perpetrator of evil. The books of Tobit and Ecclesiasticus both lay great emphasis on the giving of alms as a means to ensure God's help in one's own time of adversity. Almsgiving is simply giving to the Jewish poor, helping other Jews in their need. I haven't noticed any reference to specifically assisting those in need who are not Jewish, although in Maccabees there is much conspiring with other nations to ensure the survival of the temple, the law, and the land. Indeed, my impression is that for the Jews, religion was predominantly material rather than spiritual at times. The religious impact of Persia on Jewish beliefs is evident in the book of Tobit. Tobias, son of Tobit, wishes to marry his kinswoman Sarah. In order to do so, he must slay the evil demon Asmodeus, who loves her. This he does through the advice of his friend Azarias, who is really the angel Raphael in disguise. So if you've ever wondered where the Catholics get Gabriel, Michael, Raphael and Ariel, well, this is the answer for Raphael. It gets better. Now, Raphael advises him to burn the heart and liver of a fish on hot coals of incense in the bridal chamber. The smell of the fish made the demon flee to the upper regions of Egypt, where Raphael chained him up, Tobit 8 verse 3. It would have made me flee. They had some very strange ideas. The Jews seem to have incorporated the demonology of the Persians into their own belief system as an explanation for the seemingly inexplicable when it was adverse. Some of the authors wrote back against this inclusion, stating that only resurrection provided eternal life, no immortal souls, no people coming back from the dead. Picking up on the resurrection claim in Job, the author of 2 Maccabees relates that in preparing for burial their brothers who died fighting, Judas and his companions found that each of these dead men had been wearing an idolatrous talisman. So everyone blessed the Lord, the just judge who brings to light the most secret deeds, and prayed for the sins of these men to be completely pardoned, and sent a collection amounting to 2,000 pieces of silver to Jerusalem for a sin offering. They did all of this inspired by their belief in the resurrection of the dead. If they did not believe in their resurrection, their fallen companions would not have risen again, then it would have been a useless and foolish thing to pray for them. But they firmly believed a splendid reward for those who died as believers, so it was in keeping with the faith, and this is why Judas offered sacrifice for the dead, 2 Maccabees. I don't recall any other specific records in the Old Testament of offerings for the dead, and this is quite an assertive justification of the practice. I can't help but have a sneaking suspicion that intercession might have been made because some believed, in accordance with Persian mythology, that the spirits of sinners could not rest and might possess the living and cause havoc as demons. This sin offering might have been made to ensure the spirits were laid to rest. It's interesting that only the warriors corrupted by idolatry died. It's as if the Jews at this stage are seeking the answer to untimely death or misfortune through the attribution of sin. Jesus would later be asked, "Who sinned that this man should be born blind, he or his parents?" Christ's reply was neither. Turn your thinking from attributing blame to praising God and be glad of the opportunity for healing. Ben Sirach, the self-proclaimed author of Ecclesiasticus, was a wealthy, well-educated and well-travelled Jew who greatly admired the high priest Onias and his sons and the temple and all the pomp and splendour of worship in Jerusalem. He wrote just before the calamities recorded in Maccabees, so he didn't have to confront loss of possessions, family, friends, life or limb in war. He was concerned with writing out a legalistic prescription for his son and other Jewish males to preserve Israel against sin and loss of the land they'd returned to. If they could just stay pure enough, they would be rewarded with all the good things he had acquired in life. His final proclamation on the origin and ongoing manifestation of sin and the perpetration of evil in this world was, "Do not be taken by human beauty, and do not sit down in the company of women, for just as a moth comes out of a garment, women's wickedness comes out of a woman. Better a man's wickedness than a woman's kindness. Women bring shame and disgrace." Now there's a man who doesn't want grandchildren. For Jews like Ben Sirach, fear of contamination and had replaced genuine fear of God. Both Ben Sirach and Tobit claimed that almsgiving purified and obtained pardon for sin. It seems that by the time of Christ, the greater part of the Jews were investing all their efforts in material religious practices, forgetting the significance of these as signs of the spiritual. Although resurrection was acknowledged, the acknowledgement was fleeting. This world was the focus of Jewish thinking. Possession of the land in this life and observance of the laws and institutions seems to have become an end in itself, for which money and human lives were traded and sacrificed. This was and is an insidious form of idolatry. The sign is worshipped instead of the transcendent power and being that it signifies. When Christ finally came to Israel, he was confronted by bruised and battered Pharisees who covered their eyes so that they wouldn't be contaminated by looking at a woman, priests so obsessed with their rituals for religious cleanliness that they were straining at gnats and swallowing camels. And the common denominator among all the different factions, justify yourself and pass the blame to someone else. They were right back at Genesis, each blaming another. God had declared Adam and Eve were both wrong and both out of the garden. 4,000 years later, the true atonement for sin was about to be made, but many religious people couldn't see him because they were busy being justified in their own eyes.